replace it myself.
Everyone stay warm out there?
It's not now. It's nice. Tomorrow's supposed to be in the, I think, low 50s.
Wow, like Atlanta. Atlanta was cold for Atlanta when I was there, but it wasn't cold. It was cold for Atlanta measures.
We had 11 degrees.
11, I missed that one.
Minus 22 Celsius.
Baruch Hashem, I missed the 11 degrees weather, so I was happy. I was in the 30s, which for Atlanta was cold, but it's not cold for us over here.
The wind was insane.
Yeah, it's right here. That's right here.
So much garbage flying around. I picked up garbage. I'm reading all these manuals and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so we're up to mitzvahs. Today we're going to cover three mitzvahs. 597... 598, 599. So we're actually getting to 613. We're getting there soon, you know?
Yeah, we're getting
not so many left.
That's quite a new topic.
Yeah, we will.
We'll probably start back at number one.
I was going to say that. That's the way to do it.
No one remembers that one at this point. You could figure it out. So these mitzvot are all around the ceremony of Yibum and Chalitza. Yibum and Chalitza are a case where, unfortunately, a man dies who's married and has no children. So his brother is supposed to either do Yibum, which means to marry the widow, or Chalitza, which is the way that he releases the widow, one of the two. So I want to discuss this, the three mitzvos in terms of just what they are. The first one is the prohibition that the widow is not allowed to get remarried until something is done. I mean, she has to be either Yibum or Chalitza. She can't just get remarried without any special ceremony. Typically, a widow, she can get remarried. That's the death of a husband releases the wife from the marriage, and now she can remarry somebody else. When it comes to a case of a Yavama, that doesn't work, and she has to go through Yibum Chalitza to be able to get remarried.
Does it exist nowadays?
It does. I'll talk about how it exists, but it does exist nowadays. The second mitzvah is the mitzvah to do Yibum, which is the mitzvah, a positive command that the living brother should marry his dead brother's widow. And then there's the command of doing chalitza, which is the ceremony to release her. If they choose not to do yibum, if the brother does not want to marry the widow or vice versa, they do chalitza. And chalitza is a special procedure we'll discuss involving removing a shoe from the brother. And that is that's equivalent to, let's say, a divorce, and now she can go and get remarried. So those are our three different mitzvahs over here. So I'm going to go through just the details, and we'll discuss more what it means. It's a very interesting mitzvah. So let's just read how the Torah describes it. The Torah says, I guess I'll read the English just to make it easy for everybody. When brothers dwell together, and one of them dies, and he has no child, the wife of the deceased shall not marry outside to a strange man, meaning she can't go and get married to anybody she wants to get married to. Her brother-in-law shall come to her and take her to himself as a wife and perform leveret marriage, which is basically, we call yibum. I don't think there's any other I think leveret marriage means yibum. I don't think the word has any other meaning besides that. So that's just the word that they use in translations for yibum. We'll call it yibum. They perform yibum. It shall be that the firstborn, if she can bear, shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, so that his name not be blotted out from Israel. I mean, the Torah says the purpose of this. The purpose is that when the man die with no children, there's no one to carry on his name or his legacy. So the first child which is born to his widow, who marries his brother, that child carries on his name. And we'll see what that means. You don't have to name him the name of the person, but it means his legacy, let's call it. But if the man will not wish to marry his sister-in-law, then his sister-in-law shall ascend to the gate to the elders, and she shall say. So let's say they choose not to do yibum. They said, I don't want to marry her. She doesn't want to marry him also. She has a choice as well. So they go up to the gate, to the Beis Din, and she says, my brother-in-law refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. So she announces that my brother-in-law has refused to carry on his dead brother's name. He did not consent to perform yibum with me. So she makes that declaration. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him. So the elders actually will call in the brother-in-law, meaning the living brother, and they actually would advise him to do yibum if they felt it was proper. And he has to say, I do not wish to marry her. He has to still refuse. I don't want to do yibum. So then what happens? They do what's called chalitza. Then his sister-in-law shall approach him before the eyes of the elders. So in front of Beis Din, the widow approaches her brother-in-law. She shall remove his shoe from on his foot and spit before him. So there's actually three steps to chalitza. It's removing of the shoe, spitting, and then the declaration. Then she speaks up and she says, so is done to the man who will not build the house of his brother. Meaning it's looked at as somewhat of an embarrassing ceremony.
Right.
You know, she spits not on him, but in front of him. She says, this is what happens to the man who won't build the house of his brother, and she removes his shoe. Then his name shall be proclaimed in Israel. So then all that are assembled then will call out the house of the one whose shoe was removed. Beis Chavutzanau. So they call out, kind of in shame, this guy has had his shoe removed. And that's the end of the ceremony. So that's
Ibum. What's the reference?
This is the book of Devarim, Perachaf Hei, chapter 25. And this is verses 5 through 10. So that's the procedure. So let's just put it in other words, there's two options. So either they choose to do Yibum, which means they get married, or choose Chalitza. If they choose Chalitza, then the procedure involves removing a shoe. The lady removes the shoe from the man. She spits in front of him. And then she also has to call out and say, so is done to the man who refuses to build up his brother's household. That's the ceremony of Chalitza.
The time that it was written, the brother could be married with a wife?
Yeah.
This is in Megillat Rut, when he did not want to...
Correct, yeah. Right, correct.
And he had a wife and family.
Yeah, I mean, the prohibition of marrying more than one wife only was from Rabbeinu Gershom, you know, in about the year 1000 or so. I mean, that's fairly recent in Jewish history. It wasn't common to have more than one wife. That's clear from the Gemara, but it was allowed. It was allowed. To this very day, Svardim would be allowed to, because they never accepted that Chirim de Rabbeinu Gershom. It's not typically done nowadays, but it was done 100 years ago. But in the Sephardi countries, it was actually done. It wasn't uncommon. So the brother would have to either choose to marry the widow or do chalitza. Until this point, she cannot get remarried. She can't just say, forget about you, I'm going to marry somebody else, I'm a widow. She has to go through the ceremony before she can get remarried. So just some more details of how this works. This only applies, again, if there was no children from this first marriage. This only applies if there's a brother. It has to be a brother, they have to share fathers. If it's a half-brother through a mother, there's no halacha of Yibum. So it's only if they actually share a father. I mean, the deceased brother has a brother with the same father. Then it applies. If there's several brothers, so she only has to do Yibum or Chalitza once. One brother has to do it. The procedure typically was to go to the oldest brother first and give him the choice. And if he chose not to do Yibum, they'd then go down the list of all the brothers. If they all refused Yibum, then the oldest brother would do Chalitza. Ultimately, it'd be in his hands to decide Yibum or Chalitza. But any brother would suffice. So if a younger brother would do it, that's also fine, but it has to be done by somebody, either Yibum or Chalitza. Nowadays, so the Mishnah already tells us that we don't do Yibum, we only do Chalitza. The Mishnah says that back in earlier times, when there was some sense that the brother doing Yibum was doing it for the sake of his dead brother, L'shem Shemayim, for the sake of Hashem, then Yibum was encouraged, because that carries on the name of his deceased brother. But if we felt that he was doing it because he finds his sister-in-law attractive, he wants to get the inheritance from his brother, if people were doing it for other reasons, we would discourage it. So nowadays, we don't trust that the brothers are going to be doing this for the right reasons, and therefore the Mishnah already encourages and essentially requires at this point chalitza. So nowadays, this does it's true. The halacha still is true, and chalitzas are done occasionally. Unfortunately, it's a hard situation. I mean, someone's died and has no children. But chalitzas are done nowadays. I know there was one done in this area a couple years back. I mean, there are chalitzas that are done when the situation occurs. So so Yibum, if someone went ahead and did Yibum, it would work, they'd be married, but we discourage Yibum. And the rabbis will tell you, do Chalitza, don't do Yibum, and that's how we do it nowadays. So I want to discuss, it's a strange ceremony, Chalitza. Even the concept of Yibum is kind of strange to us. And what is the imperative, what's the idea of taking on the wife of a deceased brother? So, actually before I get to that, one more point. Before I get to that, I just want to go through maybe the details of Chalitza for a second. So chalitza is done, you take off a shoe, you spit, and you make a declaration. So the shoe should be a leather shoe. That's the lach, it should be a leather shoe, yeah?
I had read someplace you spit in the shoe.
It's not. I don't think it's in the shoe, it's just okay. In front of the person.
Yeah. Texas spit in front.
Yeah, I don't think it goes into the shoe.
Texas we spit.
It's supposed to be visible. The spit's supposed to be visible. Yeah. Halacha has to define everything, as we know. So even the spit has to be defined. So it should be visible to the judges. They should see the spit. So
certain to, volume.
Yeah. It's to be a volume which is noticeable. One little drop. Yes, it has to be noticeable. But the shoe should be a leather shoe. The shoe should fit the brother. Ideally, it should be done on his. It should be his right shoe on his right leg. He should own his shoe. Nowadays, when chalitzas are done, they're actually special shoes that different rabbanim have around the country that are designated for chalitza because it has to be halachically the right kind of shoe. So
that's not his shoe.
Well, they can then give it to him as a gift, and it becomes his shoe. Mm. I know Rabbi Heinemann's been involved in chalitzas. You know, I know he does chalitzas. I'm not sure if most shul rabbanim don't do this too often. So usually you call in like an expert to do a chalitza to make sure it's done right. So Rabbi Heinemann's done chalitzas in this area, I know, occasionally. But there are usually special shoes they would give you just to make sure it's the right kind of shoe. It should cover, you know, so it should fit. It should be his shoe. There shouldn't be any socks. It should go straight on the foot. And then they recite these different declarations, which are done. So she approaches the Yavam, unties the shoe, removes it, spits in front of him, Beis Din recites their declaration, and then that's it, and then they're free. That's how the ceremony goes. So that's our Yibum ceremony and our Chalitza ceremony. So what does all this mean? So the Torah tells us what it means. The Torah says that the purpose of Yibum was... let me just find the exact quote. Lahakim la'ichiv shem b'Yisrael. It's to uphold to his deceased brother a name amongst Israel. So this is somehow meant to carry on the dead brother's life or legacy. I mean, had he had his own children, so they'd carry on his name and his legacy. Because he doesn't have his own children, so basically he's going to, his legacy in the broader sense is lost unless we carry it on in some way. So the way we do this is that we do Yibum. Now how does it work exactly? So one approach is very simply, when you do Yibum, the living brother who does Yibum, he inherits all the property of the deceased brother. So what it means is that the property will stay within the family and his possessions will carry on to his family. That's one approach. But even more than that, it means we're kind of carrying on who he was, you know, his legacy in some way. It's viewed as a continuation of the first marriage. The way you view the Yibum marriage, it's actually, you don't do a brand new wedding ceremony. They just live together, and that creates Yibum. It's just the sexual act which is made that makes the Yibum, that first act.
And they don't
have a ketubah? No, the ketubah is the first ketubah. The original ketubah is the ketubah they use from the first marriage.
Even though the name is different?
Correct, yeah. I mean, the point being, it really just carries on that marriage. It's not made as into a new marriage. It's a continuation of the first marriage. That's how it's viewed. So all the property goes to this brother. The original ketubah is her ketubah. And there's no new kiddushin made. There's no new marriage ceremony. It's all carries on from the first marriage. So that's the idea, and then you're carrying on. So then that first child which is born, as the Pasuk says, that first child born to this couple, that child is called Al Shem HaMeis, which means this child carries on the original, it's his uncle, sort of, but that legacy. That's how you view it.
I'm sorry. The child carries on...
His dead uncle. Essentially, it's his uncle because he's born from the widow with the brother,
okay.
Right?
Yeah. I already leaped ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
This is the dead one. Is his official father?
Yeah, right. Officially, his father, but essentially, his uncle.
Biologically
it's his uncle. Right. Correct. Right. But spiritually, that's like his father. You mentioned Rus before. So in the book of Rus, this was done. There's some fulfillment in the story of Rus of Yibum. It's not exactly Yibum because it wasn't a brother; it was a cousin. But in Rus, the way that explains it is, you know, Boaz says, "Kanisi l'isha l'hakim shem ha-meis anachalaso." I have acquired Rus as my wife to uphold the name of the deceased. It's the same concept. And then once Rus has children with Boaz, so the Pasuk says that this is considered Naomi's child. I mean, Naomi was the wife of the deceased. In this case, Rus carried on the legacy based on the fact she was the daughter-in-law. This is not exactly Yibum, but it's a Yibum situation, we'll call it. And the child born was looked at as a child for Naomi in some way. This is her child to kind of carry on her children's legacy. So this is...
At the end, it gives the genealogy and it starts with Paris and goes through Boaz.
Correct, because biologically,
biologically. I mean, to get to
there's a spirit, there's a spiritual kind of, you know, fulfillment, and then there's also the biological, you know, the descent. Biologically, it was Boaz's child. But spiritually, there was some fulfillment of it being a child of Naomi, you know, along those lines.
Well, there's the earlier incident of Tamar
and Yehuda. I'm going to talk about that also.
Okay.
So Yibum exists beyond this situation. I mean, the situation we're talking about is a brother and a sister-in-law. Technically, a brother and a sister-in-law is considered a rias. That's an illicit relation, typically. Only in a case of Yibum is it allowed. If the two of them were to marry in another situation, that'd be considered a rias, that'd be considered an incestual relationship, or that'd be considered a legal relationship, they would be chayiv kares. It's a terrible crime in the Torah to marry your sister-in-law, unless it's a yibum situation where it's a mitzvah. So it's one of these interesting cases where you have that. But beyond that, the Torah does have in places, such as the story of Rus, or as Art mentioned, Tamar and Yehuda, where you have a yibum, we'll call it, situation that's not brother-in-law and sister-in-law. Meaning what? Sometimes you can have people who have died, and the family, in the broader sense, takes on the widow. So in the case of Rus, she married a cousin of her dead husband. And that was considered a fulfillment of, it wasn't the mitzvah of Yibum exactly, but it was a fulfillment of that concept. So to Tamar and Yehuda, Yehuda married his daughter-in-law, in that case, had children through his daughter-in-law. And that was also considered a Yibum fulfillment, which many commentaries talk about. So even though it wasn't the exact situation, it was taking on a dead family member's wife and having children with her, and that carries on the name of the dead family member. That's something which is a concept which exists beyond our exact halachas over here. The case of Tamar and Yehuda was before the Torah was given. So therefore, that was considered, let's call it a Yibum situation. If that was done nowadays, the daughter-in-law and father-in-law is also considered an illicit relationship, and that would be a terrible thing to do. But in those days, before Torah was given, that was allowed, and that was considered a fulfillment of Yibum, because taking on a family member's widow is considered you're carrying on his name. So it's very interesting
all
how...
All these things, only there's no children involved?
Yeah, no children involved, right. Rus had no children with her husband, who died,
right.
And Tamar had no children until this point either. So yeah, if there's children involved, then he's already carried on through the children. You don't need to do Yibum. Correct.
And there's the link.
And what?
From Tamar down through Boaz.
Yes, yeah. The family has at least situations, correct. As I said, nowadays we encourage chalitza and not Yibum, just because we feel, the rabbis felt, in the Mishnayos even, that people won't have the proper intent when fulfilling Yibum. And therefore ends up being more an excuse to get married to your sister-in-law or take your brother's money rather than carrying on his name. So therefore, we don't encourage that anymore. The chalitza ceremony is very interesting because the way you do chalitza is very odd. The spitting and the shoe, like, where does this all come from? So many commentaries try to explain exactly what are these points of the chalitza ceremony. What does it mean? So Rabbeinu Bachaya says that one point of chalitza is to show the finality of the situation. I mean, they're given a choice. You can marry or you can split. Now, once they split, they can never take back that decision. Once they split, they've decided we're not carrying on the brother's name. We are going our own ways and finished. They won't be allowed to get married after that. Once, if they get married after that, you know, they're back to the issue of you can't marry your sister-in-law. They get this one chance right now of Yibum, and if they give up that chance, they give up that chance.
Is there a certain amount of time after the husband dies before they do the ceremony?
No, I mean, they should do it technically right away. The only time limit involved is you want to give 3 months between the death and the ceremony, and her getting in the ceremony, because in case she's pregnant, you want to know who the father was.
Right.
So you wouldn't do Yibum for 3 months. Chalitza, I think, can be done immediately, because as long as she's not getting remarried, then we know if she's pregnant who the father was. So I think Chalitza can be done immediately. But if you don't do Chalitza, then the ban never ends until you do Chalitza. So it's like an aguna to some degree. It has to be done. So we're trying to show the finality of the situation. So Rabbeinu Bachaya says, removing shoes, we know, is a sign of mourning. Mourners don't wear shoes. And until this point, in some sense, the brother is still alive, because we still have the chance to carry on his name. Once you do chalitza, you're saying we're not carrying him on anymore. No, he's really dead now. and therefore you remove the shoes to show a sign of mourning, but now there's a finality in the situation, he's really gone. So that's one way to explain the removing of the shoe. The Sefer HaChinuch says that the spitting, it also shows they're splitting up, meaning that now, when a woman's married to her to a husband, hopefully she shows him honor and doesn't spit at him. We hope. The spitting shows, I have no more bond to you. I have no more reason to honor you because you're a stranger to me. I'm going to spit and go my own way. And so they're both showing the finality. The moving the shoes is the idea that the dead brother is now going to be officially dead because no one's carrying on his name. The spitting shows that there's no more honor being accorded to the living brother because we're splitting and I'm not going to be your wife. And therefore, we have this concept of the shoe and the spitting. But there's a much deeper point here as well. And the deeper point is that many of the different commentaries discuss that not only is this child carrying on the dead brother's name, but in a deeper sense, the dead brother could be a Gilgal Neshama reincarnated through this child. The Torah doesn't speak directly ever, to my knowledge, about reincarnation, Gilgal Neshamas as we call it. But this is one source we have for this concept, which is that when we say that the brother is carried on through this child, it's not just a legacy, but his actual neshama may be stuck into this new child which is born. And he really gets another chance at life through this child. That's one way the different commentaries describe it. And that idea is a very deep idea. And the idea of reincarnation is something the Jews do believe in, and that we believe the neshama gets chances to come back and do its job. So if it failed the first time around, it'll come back another time to do its job. If it fails a second time, it comes back a third time. Because Hashem wants it that every single neshama fulfills its purpose in this world. So every time it fails, it might come back for another chance at a later date. Yeah.
So what is the difference between reincarnation and resurrection?
Well, resurrection is that's a form of reward. I mean, resurrection is at the end of time, when everyone's done their job, everyone can come back and enjoy the perfect world. Reincarnation is that you haven't done your job yet, and we're giving you another chance. Hashem wants to give us chances. He doesn't want us to fail. So he'll say, okay, try again, try again, try again, until we get it right. So the idea of Yibum is not just to carry on a legacy or carry on his property, it's to carry him on spiritually. The spirit of the dead brother ends up with this new child. So how does it work with removing the shoe? What's the concept of removing the shoe? So many explain, I'll quote from the Abarbanel. He says that a shoe to a foot can be compared to a body to a neshama. Why is that? He says that a foot moves, a foot's dynamic, a foot's alive, a foot takes us places, but your feet don't do you much good without shoes. Try to go out right now in the snow without shoes. Try to go out on a hot summer day. Try to go through a forest. Try to go through a desert not wearing shoes. Your feet aren't so effective. Eventually, it's going to be very difficult, very painful. So the shoe is like the body to the neshama because the shoe allows the foot to do what it has to do. Without the shoe, the foot doesn't do very good, do much good for us. Even though the shoe is a separate object and the shoe is not dynamic, it's inanimate, it's just a shoe, but that enables the foot to do its job. So too, the neshama is the dynamic part of the person. The neshama is chai, it's alive. The neshama has ambitions. The neshama has movement. The neshama wants to act. And a neshama in this world, without a body, can't do anything. This world's a physical world, and you have to have a body to interact with the world. Without that, the neshamas in the world without bodies, they might be everywhere, they don't mean anything to us. It's worthless. And a neshama with a body, suddenly you have a human being. You have somebody who can come into this world and accomplish tremendous things. That's a neshama. So the body is like the shoe for the neshama. The body on its own right is a piece of flesh. It's just like the shoe is a piece of a leather shoe is a piece of animal. It's leather. It's also like flesh, and the shoe itself is inanimate. A body we know after someone dies, the body is inanimate. It goes back into the ground once again where it started. What gives it its ability to function is the neshama. When the two are fused together, that's how you create a human being. So yibum would be a way to bring the neshama back into another body. This brother has passed away. His neshama has left his body. The neshama is like that foot with no shoe. And yibum would be granting that foot another shoe. Yibum is allowing that neshama to come into another body. When you do chalitza, what you're saying is that I'm removing the shoe. I'm taking away the chance of that neshama to come back into this world, to come back into the physical body, to come back into a shoe. So the symbol of chalitza is a much deeper symbol. It's that this brother's neshama is waiting for another chance. And by doing chalitza, we're depriving it of that chance. We're taking away its shoe so it can't function. It's like a foot without a shoe. The foot can't go anywhere. So that's the way the Abarbanel describes the ceremony of chalitza. A little more practical for us is to maybe say in a little different way. Now we want to give this. Let's forget for a second the idea of an neshama, of reincarnation. That's maybe a little bit too deep for us. But let's take it from a different perspective. Now you want to give the deceased a connection to the world. You want to give the deceased a way in which he still can impact our world. So he can't do it because he's passed away. But a child in his name is that connection. So again, putting aside reincarnation, the fact that there's a human being in this world that is created because of this deceased person, and this person now is in the world acting, doing mitzvos, learning Torah, helping others, this person is allowing the deceased to interact with the world now and still gain merit, and still gain schar, and still gain reward through his interaction in this world. He still has a legacy. So whether you want to see it as reincarnation, or whether you want to see it more practically, just as a legacy of somebody carrying on his name, that's what Yibum does. So when you do chalitza, you're saying we're cutting you off. Now you have no children, we're not going to do Yibum, so your shoes are removed. You can no longer interact with our world. So your neshama is going to remain in Shemayim, and the world's going to be without your influence right now. That's why chalitza is considered a finality. Ideally, we always encourage Yibum. It's just when people weren't able to do it with the proper intent, we stopped doing it. But that's the ceremony of chalitza. So I want to say maybe practically we have some lessons from this. The situation of Yibum Chalitza itself is always tragic. I mean, it means somebody has died. It means they've died without any children. It's a tragic situation. But to take it into more or less practical daily life, you know, all of us are very familiar with the practice. When someone passes away, we try to carry on things in their name. Give stucca. We learn their merit. We daven their merits. We do things to carry on that legacy. And I think that Yibum is a major source for this concept. I mean, even someone who dies with children, but we try to carry on their name any way we can because we want their impact to remain in our world. We want their impact to still be here, and we want to still accrue merits on their behalf. So all of us are familiar with many practices we do on yurt sites, or we name things in the name of those who have passed away. We name children in their name. And all these things are ways to carry on the legacy of those who are dear to us, who've passed on, to give them that merit in our world. So if someone has no children, even more so, we have to do our best to carry that name on because there's no people who descend from them. But even people who have children, we want to be able to carry on their name in any way we can, and that's the concept of doing things in the merit and the schus of those who've passed on. So it's an important concept. So Yibum is a very particular situation where we do it this way, but I think the concept is even broader than Yibum. I think that the concept applies to us in many, many, many fasts we're all very familiar with. On Yortzeit, people will dive in and learn, and you make brachos for the neshama of the person who had died. These are all ways you always try to accrue merits and carry on the legacy of those who passed on. Just to maybe add in a few other related points over here. It's very fascinating to me, and this is something I just thought of, I don't know if it's right, but we know when the brothers sold Yosef, so the rabbis tell us that, how they spend the money? The brothers sold Yosef, they made, I assume, and the Torah says how much money they made, I think it's a nice amount of money. So what did they do with that money? Anybody know? So based on a pasuk in Amos, it says that they bought shoes with that money. That's what the rabbis tell us. It says in the pasuk in Amos says, "Al michram bekesef," because you sold for money, tzaddik ve'evyon, somebody who's a tzaddik and poor, ba'ad na'alayim, for the sake of shoes. So the rabbis say that refers to Yosef's sale, and they sold Yosef, who was a tzaddik, Yosef a tzaddik, for the sake of buying shoes. So I was trying to think, what's the connection? The brothers were so cruel and so insensitive. Okay, let's go get some new shoes with this money now. Like, what are they trying to show? So I would suggest that maybe the brothers felt, Yosef was somebody who did, he at that point he had no children, and they cut him off from the family. So they felt that they still wanted to, in some way, carry on Yosef's legacy within the family, despite the fact they cut him off. So maybe the symbolism of buying shoes, that money, shows that even though we're sending him off, he still has shoes. Just a suggestion, just a thought. Because it really is the situation of brothers with another brother who had no children at the time, and they got shoes. They bought. So it's the opposite of chalitza. Instead of taking off shoes, they put on shoes and saying, even though we sold him off, This is all for a purpose, and we're going to try to carry him on in some way within our family. It's just a thought.
It's a medrash.
I don't know. It's a medrash that, yeah, they sold him for shoes. We actually say it on Yom Kippur, in Musaf. We talk about the 10 Harugi Malchus, the 10 martyrs. And those 10 martyrs correspond to the 10 brothers who sold Yosef. And in that piyut, I actually mentioned something, you know, all for the sake of shoes, something like that. So we actually talk about in Yom Kippur, this concept. It's interesting. Remember this, sound familiar. While we're talking about shoes, I mean, shoes themselves, there's a lot of references to shoes that we find in the Torah, we find in the Gemara. We know Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush had to take off his shoes. Shana lechem al raglecha. Take off your shoes, you're standing on holy ground. We know that the Kohanim, when they did the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, couldn't wear shoes. Right? They weren't allowed to serve in shoes. If they served in shoes, the avodah was invalid. They had to take off their shoes. So there's an idea that sometimes you should have your shoes off. Right? Chalitza is taking shoes off in a negative sense, you know, sort of an embarrassing way. But there are times where shoes are supposed to be off. So what are those times? Additionally, the Medrash says, "Kol makom she'at shechina nigles." Anywhere where the shechina appears, you can't wear shoes. So, like it says, you're on holy ground, Moshe. You take off your shoes. So, when are shoes appropriate and when are shoes inappropriate? So I think based on what we've been describing, it's the following: the idea of a shoe is that it allows you to interact with the world. A shoe tells you, I have somewhere to go, I have something to do, I can be productive. You take off your shoes at night when you're at home and you want to relax, you put on your slippers, take them off, you go to sleep. But when you want to go out and to have a productive day, put on shoes. So if you have somewhere to go, something to accomplish, somewhere you should be going, your shoes are on. If you're standing on holy ground, where else do you have to go right now? No, where else do you want to be? This is where you're supposed to be. And therefore, you take off your shoes to show that I'm where I'm supposed to be right now. I have nowhere else to go. When you're at home, you take off your shoes. So it's that I think one of the concept of where the Shekhinah is revealed, there's no shoes. One idea is that because where the Shekhinah is, that's where you're supposed to be in life. You're supposed to always be moving towards being closer to Hashem. And when you're standing in Hashem's presence, say, Hashem, I'm putting my shoes on and getting out of here, then you're missing the point. Because the point is you've actually reached your goal. On the other hand, it says when the Jews would go up for Alila Regio, the pilgrimage on a holiday. So the pasuk tells us, "Mayafu pamayich bana olam bas nadiv." How beautiful are your feet and shoes, the daughter of the generous one.
Shir
Hashirim. Correct. And the rabbis say that pamayich bana olam refers to the Jews making Alila Regio when they're going up to the Samikdash on the holidays. We're saying your shoes are so beautiful because that's the opposite. Because then they're heading somewhere. The shoes are beautiful because you're heading towards the holiness. You're heading towards the Shekhinah. You're in your own city, outside, somewhere in Eretz Yisrael, far away from Yerushalayim. You put on those shoes to go up to the Beis HaMikdash for the holiday. So those shoes are beautiful on your feet because those shoes are taking you where you need to go. So that's beautiful shoes. So when you're standing in the Beis HaMikdash, you take off your shoes. But when you are ascending to the Beis HaMikdash, your shoes are beautiful because they're taking you in this world where you should be, to a place of holiness. Every morning when we wake up, one of the brachos said is Sha'asali Kol Tzarki. Hashem performed all of my needs. And the rabbis say that bracha actually is focused on putting on shoes. The rabbis say that in the Gemara originally, all those brachos in the morning were said at different steps of your morning routine. So, you know, you open up your eyes, Bokeh Ivrim, you put on your clothes, Mabu Sharumim. So when you put on your shoes, Sha'asali Kol Tzarki. So shoes are called all my needs. We look at shoes as all my needs. And I think it's the same concept because what you need to accomplish in this world, without the shoes, you can't go anywhere. My needs in this world, that I'm able to go out, be productive, do what has to be done, and that's all symbolized by my shoes. So my shoes are kol tzarki. The Gemara says a person should sell even the beams of his house to buy a pair of shoes. And Rabbi Akiva told his son, Rabbi Yeshua, he says, never hold back from putting shoes on your feet. I think it's all the same idea. The importance of shoes symbolically is that because shoes are a ticket to accomplishment. It's our ticket to go out there in the world and do. And without those shoes, we can't do much. So we're always focused on productivity, and that's the shoes. There's one last quote about shoes. So we spoke about shoes today. Just everybody. But I could find it. Rav Hirsch speaks about the idea of shoes in his commentary in the Chumash, when Moshe is the burning bush. So our verse speaks about why would one take off their shoes on holy ground. So he gives a little different perspective. He says that when you're on holy ground, you remove your shoes because instead of trying to find out about the phenomenon that lies beyond and outside your sphere, understand the destiny of the ground on which you already stand and give yourself up entirely to that. I mean, wearing shoes means, okay, I got to go somewhere else. I have something else to look into. If you're standing on holy ground, your focus is, I'm where I need to be. Let me dedicate myself to this. Let me give myself up to where I am. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying right here right now. This is where I'm supposed to be. Taking off one's shoes expresses giving oneself up entirely to the meaning of a place. To let your personality get its standing and take up its position entirely and directly on it without any intermediary. So shoes mean I'm connected to where I am. Excuse me, taking off my shoes means I'm connected. Shoes are interrupt. Shoes block between myself and the ground. So usually I don't want to be stuck on the ground that I'm standing on, so I have shoes on. But when I'm in a holy place, I want no interruption. I want no blockage between myself and the holy ground. I take off my shoes. So the Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash had always to function barefoot. And they couldn't have anything interrupting between their feet and the ground, or between their hands and the holy vessels. Because you're showing that this is what I want to connect to. I don't need any blockade over here. Nothing should block me. So on the one hand, a shoe allows us to interact with the world. And we know when you take off the shoe of the Yavam, that ends the process of the dead brother from interacting with the world. However, sometimes shoes should be removed. When you're standing on holy ground, you're showing this is where I need to be. I don't need to go interact with the world. I am where I'm supposed to be. I'm going to submit myself to my current situation, and I have nowhere else to go. And that's when you're on the holy ground of the Beis HaMikdash. That's when you're standing there with Hashem speaking to you, if you're Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's where shoes are not called for. So we have times where you should wear shoes, times we should not wear shoes. As a very interesting aside, there's different customs upon wearing shoes inside a shul. And in the world, typically, it's fascinating because in the, let's say, the European culture, which we live in, so wearing a shoe is respectful, being barefoot is disrespectful. In, let's say, like Sephardi culture, shoes are disrespectful, and being barefoot is respectful. In the Far East, you walk into a house, you take off your shoes. Many Sephardi Jews, classically, would take off their shoes even to go into shul. For an Ashkenazi Jew, that sounds ridiculous. Of course you don't take off your shoes. How inappropriate. But the wearing or not wearing of shoes is very much a cultural concept that you find. So whether it be culturally, halachically, it's the same thing with hats. You know, in some cultures, hats are respectful, and some they're disrespectful. In America, you're supposed to take off your hat going into the building. You know, for Jews, we wear hats out of respect. It's very different based on culture. But shoes are like that, and shoes do have that concept of I'm ready to go out of the world. I don't want to be here. I want to go somewhere else. That would be the disrespectful part of shoes. On the other hand, when you wear shoes, you're taking the dirt of the street into where you are. So you have both those kind of... That's the interesting, the difference in culture you have in different parts of the world. Okay.
Has it been decided when the third base of Mikdash is built?